the House and Senate Tax Conference Committee. Today we are going to be talking about tax competitiveness, and we have a distinguished list of folks that would like to address the committee, and so we'll get started right away. The first person on our list is Kay Rockow of NAIOP. If you could come forward, please. You could state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing the interests of developers, owners, and managers of commercial real estate, along with the thousands of tenants who are in all of the buildings that we own and manage. And we're here this morning to give you a couple of perspectives on the impact of Minnesota's property tax system on business property taxpayers. We're going to speak from the perspective of a manufacturer who competes globally, as well as a developer and owner of multi-tenant buildings across the country. Before we get started, I just want to say that the Minnesota Taxpayers Association has recently updated their 50-state property tax rankings for payable 2010. And again, their study continues to show a high burden for business properties in Minnesota. A couple of key findings from that report for business property taxes payable in 2010. Urban and rural, $25 million commercial properties, and rural, $1 million commercial properties are still all ranked well within the top 10. Industrial burdens generally range from 10% below the national averages to 20% above the national averages, depending on property values and location within the state. And even though commercial properties in Minnesota have experienced significant competitive improvement since 1995, when comparing three different property values of commercial buildings in Minneapolis, property taxes payable are still 12 to 44% above the national average. When comparing three different property values on commercial buildings in Glencoe, property taxes payable are 19 to 54% above the national average. And I just want to say on behalf of all business property taxpayers across the state, we want to thank you for the provisions in your bill which either reduce or phase out the state general tax, which has increased 34% since its first payable year in 2002. And this is really important because it is the one tax that all businesses pay. Whether they're large or small, regardless of income, whether they make any money or not, whether they lease their space or whether they own their building, and these are Minnesota's job creators. And this is a fixed cost which they have little or no control over. And again, we want to make sure that you know how much we appreciate your efforts in this area. And now I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Wise.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Steve Wise. I am an owner-operator at a company called Cast Screw Machine Products up in Brooklyn Center. We've been in business since 1945. I'm also on the Twin West board.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. Company history, like I said, since 1945, up on the corner there in Brooklyn Center, since 1965. Our big customers are Bobcat, Polaris, Toro, folks that you've heard of. I brought some of my widgets in here. We do not have a product of our own. We make other people's parts. My competition is not just local, it is global. The big heat now comes from China and India. China is not even considered a low-cost country anymore. Now it's places like Taiwan and Vietnam. So I've got huge competition from overseas. My recession numbers, before everything fell apart in 2008, I had about 125 employees. We went down to about 75. We have struggled our way back up to about 90 now. We are enjoying a little bit more activity now based on some more consumer confidence around the country, like most people are enjoying right now. If people don't have money to buy the machines that my parts are part of, we're not making any money either. Now, the competition that I talked about overseas, we can do a lot of efficiencies around my shop. But what's unfortunate is, as much as we try and get more efficient, the competition overseas, it's the labor portion is what's the hardest. So the fixed costs that are part of my overall costs are the hardest part for me to control. When property taxes are fixed costs that strike my bottom line. So the bottom line is two things happen when Minnesota businesses continue to be strapped with burdensome fixed costs. Number one, we need to work longer and harder to cover those costs, resulting in decreased profitability and less opportunity to provide benefits or expand. And number two, it becomes necessary to pass these costs along to my customers, and my customers are then motivated to move that business to other places like North Dakota and Iowa, which I'm getting a lot of competition from right now. Just a little anecdotal story. I just got a note from one of my biggest customers. That's about 33% of my overall business. They have three goals for me in 2011. They want my quality to get better, they want my delivery to get better, and they want my prices to drop 3%. How are my prices going to drop 3%, people? I'd enjoy anybody to help me with this one, because my material costs this last year have gone up over 25% in 1 year. My material costs. Electricity goes up, insurance goes up, and my property taxes went up. Even though my property tax values went down, my property taxes went up. I don't know how I'm going to meet that goal for my biggest customer. Up on the corner in Brooklyn Center, we have assessed value of $4.5 million in buildings. Sounds like a lot of money up there in real estate, but that real estate is worth nothing if we aren't making parts and making money. My property tax values went down $178,000, but my property taxes went up $7,500. I look at myself, my business, we're not in business only to make money. And my profit margin is about 6%. So there's a lot of people around this room that would say, he's only making 6%. Why doesn't he take all those assets and throw them in a TCF, money market certificate, and make his money there? Because it's kind of a headache to be in business. But you know what? What we're doing up in Brooklyn Center, we're providing jobs for 90 families. We're providing good benefits and retirements. It's more than just making money up there. In business, we negotiate many things. We negotiate our materials. We negotiate our electricity and our insurance. So thank you for letting me take part in this negotiation to keep our Minnesota business climate tax competitive.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Masha. I'm the Senior Vice President of Twin Cities Operations for Duke Realty Corporation. In the Twin Cities, we own about 5 million square feet of office, industrial, and retail properties. Nationally, we own about 140 million square feet in approximately 20 markets. We are an owner, we are a developer, we are a property manager, and try to provide full service to Minnesota's employers here who are our tenants in our buildings. About 1.3 million of our portfolio is office buildings, about 4 million square feet of our portfolio is industrial buildings, and we own one retail project that's in St. Louis Park called the West End. And I want to refer back to a couple of things that Kay mentioned and also that Steve mentioned. And I also want to thank you for your time today and for listening to us testify in front of you. And I think one of the things that's great is that we've got such an opportunity. I think this is a place, and Steve touched on it, in terms of the loyalty of people who are here and why do they stay here. I think we have such a great opportunity to start juicing that a little bit, because once companies are here, they don't like to leave. They don't want to leave because it's a great place to be. And I think we have an opportunity to push things over the edge and really get the economy and the local economy humming if we can start minimizing some of these fixed costs that impact our employers and our tenants and our buildings. And that's the key driver here, is that we as an owner and a developer of real estate aren't great job creators. We're in business to provide the space for our tenants to employ people and to grow and to become better businesses. And as Kay mentioned, real estate taxes are a fixed cost of that business. And I think one of the things that everybody on the committee needs to understand is that the way our business operates, those costs are passed through directly to the tenants. Real estate taxes aren't paid by the out-of-town landlord owners of buildings. They're passed through in the leases to those tenants 100%. About the only portion of that tax bill that the owner will pay is any part of the tax bill that relates to open vacant space in the building. Unless you're a company like Steve's that owns its own building, then obviously they're paying their own real estate taxes. But for our company, which is a public real estate investment trust, we pass all of those real estate taxes down onto those tenants. So the impact of higher taxes falls on the employers, not on the owners. Secondly, existing vacancy rates right now. When we build a building, we employ lots of people to build a building. If we're going to put an office building up, we might have 200 people work on that particular job. But there isn't going to be any new development anytime soon because vacancy rates right now on the office side and also on the industrial side are approximately 19%. And in this market, those numbers are pretty big. This is about a 72 million square foot office market in the Twin Cities. That means we have approximately 14.3 million square feet that's vacant space today. On the industrial side, we have 102 million square feet in the market, and we have about 17.5 million square feet of vacant space, using rough numbers from end of 2010 numbers into 2011. And things are starting to get a little bit better. And it's starting to feel better. And Steve mentioned consumer confidence. And there seems to be more consumer confidence out there. There seems to be more confidence in the business environment. And companies seem to be a little bit more willing to start spending space and maybe grow a little bit and hire some people. And we're starting to see some signs of that in the market. However, we've got so much space, so much ground that we have to gain in order for us to get to a point where we can start growing in our industry. And our tenants really have to start hiring, adding people, because that is the one key thing that drives our business. Job growth drives our business. If we don't have job growth, we can't fill that space, we can't build new space, and we can't keep things going. So what we really need is to create an environment that allows our tenants to grow and allows our employers, the small businesses, the large businesses in Minnesota, to grow, to hire people, and to get us back on track. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Masha. We'll open up for questions from conferees to Ms. Rocco, Mr. Wise, or Mr. Masha. Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I first want to thank you for coming here today to testify and share your experience on this. When we discussed in the House and reducing the statewide property tax for our businesses, it's very important. It's something that I hear from the Twin West quite a bit. And I can see from what your testimony was here today that as a business, you're impacted by the success of other businesses as well, and that's a key a piece of this. And that's what, at least from the House perspective, that's what was our goal, was to try and make sure that we can give you that economic recovery and the confidence. And, you know, it all trickles down to the individual consumer in their home going out and buying products. It's all related, and that's what our goal was here today. And I'm just curious if we can find out from the governor, the commissioner today, has the governor looked at this specific provision of the bill, and what are his thoughts on reducing the statewide property tax? And if he could get some feedback on that, that would be helpful.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, thank you very much for the question. Clearly, what the governor has tried to do with respect to property taxes is to provide to reduce the pressure on state and local governments to increase property taxes. And so by not making any cuts to local government aid, the governor has done what he believes is a necessary stop on the pressures for stopping the increases on the local level. With respect to the provision before the committee today, the governor does not have a position on this particular provision. Right now, he prefers the provision that he has provided for in the way of no reductions to state and local state and local government aid to reduce the pressure to increase property taxes statewide. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that the governor is pushing for that piece. You know, I'm just curious if you have statistics to show that increased spending for local government aid has resulted in lower property taxes, because what I've heard from the testimony from these folks today that actually hasn't happened.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, under the governor's proposal, actually, we believe that the business property taxes will actually be lower than they would have been otherwise. It's clearly an important aspect, and one of the things that, in terms of competitiveness for the state of Minnesota, the governor has made it quite clear that he wants to make sure that we don't add to the burdens of the local businesses in various states and in various counties and various cities. So his position is quite clear in trying to make sure that there's no added pressure. And, in fact, under the proposal, as we've studied it, the local property taxes for businesses would actually be somewhat less.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, does that mean then the governor supports our provision as far as putting levy limits, extending the levy limits to make sure that we don't add any additional pressure on the businesses and make sure that we are remaining competitive?
Commissioner France.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor does not have a preference at this time for the conference committee. And at some point, once there is a final provision, we would be glad to weigh in on that. But at this time, we don't support any particular provision, have no preference for whatever provision this conference committee has before it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
So I take it the governor's, you're saying the governor's not opposed to that then? And do you know time-wise when he's going to get engaged in the process so that we can move forward from here at all?
Mr. France.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor is engaged now. We're ready to move forward as soon as this committee puts forward a bill and a final position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Commissioner, you know, I understand that, what is this, week two probably for you on the job, and, you know, you're a hearty soul for jumping in the middle of a legislative session. But, you know, traditionally the governor, whoever it is and whoever's in charge of the legislature, has been engaged in the process from the get-go with the idea that we aren't just kind of going through the motions just to have him veto it. And I think that's what our goal here today is with the conference committee, is asking for the governor to come to the table and join us in trying to work together in a solution. And you know, from everything that I've heard from the governor, I assume that that's what he wants to do. But without him being here and participating in the process, we can't truly get to a solution that we can all agree on. So I know that you're just the messenger here today, but if you could ask him to, we would like to know his thoughts on these different provisions, because that helps us in knowing what to put together as a final bill for him to look at. But, you know, without that kind of feedback, it makes it difficult for us to put together a package that we can all agree on. So I just ask that you take that back to him. And again, testifiers, I want to thank you for coming today, and I appreciate you staying in Minnesota, and keep doing business here. So
thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just of the two witnesses, I see you picked out this discussion of the property taxes, but could you give us a little bit of sense as you look at the corporate income tax versus property tax? I mean, which to you, you know, would be more preferable to fix in Minnesota? You have a...
Is this directed to Mr. Wise or Mr.
Either one of Mr. Wise or Mr.
Wise.
Moshe?
Representative Runbeck, I would... Mr. Chair, I would say that, no, I think from our standpoint, when we talk to tenants and overall competitiveness, it's a total sum game. And costs for them need to be lower in general. And whether that comes here, there, et cetera, they're looking at, I think, more of a bottom line number and saying, where can I be more competitive? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Would Mr. Wise be able to?
Mr. Wise.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, Mr. Chair, it is kind of a sum game, and I don't pretend to have the knowledge to know what the most equitable way to, which one to fix first. I'm an S corporation, so the income that my company makes is passed through to my individual income tax form, which makes my income tax form look great to my ex-wife, but unfortunately, what it really boils down to is that I pay an awful lot of taxes on the income that my company earns. I think we need to look at our overall tax structure as a larger picture, and because property taxes on businesses, they don't sit real well. Because it's a tax on a value. If I quit making parts up in those buildings up there and they went vacant, I guarantee you they would sit empty for more than a couple years. The reason I can guarantee that is because there's two of them on my block right now that are empty. They haven't had a walkthrough in 2 years. They are worth nothing. So I'm being taxed on something that has a hypothetical value. Right now that tax percentage is about 4% of the total value of those buildings. Whereas you look at the homes that you people all live in, assuming that you own your homes, it's about 1 to 1.5% of the total value. And that value is actually a little more marketable than I think what's going on with the marketable value of businesses. So fix everything. I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, run back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had a lot of discussion here in the last few months about property taxes and, you know, what – What can you do at the local level? I mean, do you sense you have any leverage at all with your city government in terms of them understanding your issues? I mean, really, property taxes, you know, other than the statewide portion of it, but the local property taxes come off your city spending. And I appreciate what NIOP has done, a great piece you put out for all of us to really say we need to really drill down on the costs of these local governments. And so do you have frustration? Do you see that there are services you don't take advantage of or can't use that you're paying for?
Well, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. You know, I up in Brooklyn Center, when you think of Brooklyn Center, you think of that big white elephant up there called Brookdale. And it's not even so much a white elephant anymore as a big lump of clay that just sits there and doesn't have any tax revenue for my city. So, and there's no magic when it comes to city taxes. They have to somehow equitably find a way to distribute the tax base among businesses and residences. We don't use a whole lot of city services in my little corner. We do work very closely with the city. Anytime that we need something, they've always been very happy to have us there because they recognize that we are a nice tax base for them. We work closely with them. We have never challenged them on how they spend their money, though.
Representative Runbeck.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think that is interesting. I would urge you to get more involved in that budget and start to challenge.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weiss, you made an interesting comment that Iowa's kicking you around a little bit. And I live about 8 miles from the Iowa border, and you live in Brooklyn Center. So I guess my question, there's two questions here, actually, is when you look at a business and you say, what can we do to help you be more competitive? What is Minnesota doing wrong? What can we change for you? There's really not one single issue that pops out. Is that correct? It's kind of a culmination of mandates, regulations, taxes, whatever. But I am going to ask you that question anyway, if there's something that we can't fix. And what is the competitive advantage to these other states around us or that you're facing? And what are they doing right and we're doing wrong?
Mr. Wise.
Senator and Mr. Chair, well, thank you for giving me a chance to mention this. My own passion is workforce development. And as we're growing right now, we're having a really difficult time finding qualified machinists. So from that aspect, I have had competitors and associates of mine expand into North Dakota and Iowa. They have some good workforce developments down there, some great vo-techs and community colleges that they're really training their young people very, very well. I don't think we're doing as good a job in Minnesota as we could. Partnering with our vocational technical schools and our businesses, I think that's an important partnership to develop, and whatever this group could do to foster that, I'd be thankful for.
Senator Rosen.
Is there something that something else as far as this committee can handle on the tax base or on something that we can help you with? It would be more of an advantage. I know Iowa's getting very competitive on their business tax.
Mr. Wise.
Yeah. Well, Senator and Mr. Chair, again, the fixed costs that come across my business that I have no control over, property taxes in particular, are entirely burdensome, and they do cut into my bottom line. And like I said, we are trying to provide benefits and jobs to people up there in Brooklyn Center to 100 families. And if you can somehow help me control my fixed costs, that's it.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
Mr. Wise, what is that you have in front of you there? Is it like getting kind of old, those three things?
Oh, these little doodads?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, these are just typical of the parts I make. Like I said, I do not have a part. I don't like market a bunch of screws. I have people send me emails from all over the world saying they want to buy a quarter-inch 40 socket head drill or screw. I don't sell those. This is a part for Polaris. This is a part for Toro. These two other little widgets are parts for Oildyne. What happens is these OEMs, they send out a quote for a part like this to, you know, they're four good vendors that they have that would make a part like this. But there's probably 100 people around the country that can make a part like this. This is a part that I make about 20,000 pieces of a year. And that part is real easy to farm out to anybody else in the country or the world.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, I want to speak to the House members and others here on behalf of the Senate position in the bill on the statewide business property tax, especially as to Mr. Wise's point. It's a fixed cost for every business. It's not just the successful businesses or the startup businesses. It's businesses with one employee or businesses with thousands of employees in the state or multiple locations. Every business will be affected, and so will all of their employees if we repeal the statewide business property tax. It is, in my view, the best place to start with tax reform and helping our businesses. The corporate income tax is regressive, to be sure, but it doesn't affect all businesses like the statewide business property tax does. I beg to differ with Commissioner Franz regarding the governor's position. I don't see his position being business-friendly at all. In fact, he's got corporate income tax increases by eliminating FOCs and foreign royalty deductions to the tune of $370 million that the governor would take out of the backs of our businesses at this point in Minnesota when we're trying to grow the economy and help these businesses succeed. And those corporate income taxes are very regressive and get passed along to consumers, and they get passed along to labor and make it far less competitive in the state of Minnesota, and folks will have incentives to look to do business in other states in more business-friendly climates. So I appreciate the fact that the House does have statewide business property tax reductions. I think that it's about $50 million in this biennium. The Senate goes a little further to $114, but our plan is to repeal the statewide business tax by 2023, and I'm hoping that the members of the House will agree with the Senate position on that, that should be our highest priorities, because those startup businesses need our help. They're not going to rent that office space with the fixed costs of doing business. We can cut those fixed costs, and we can make it less expensive, and we can send the message that it's going to get even better over the next few years as we repeal and phase out that statewide business property tax all the way to 2023. And frankly, it's a pretty new tax. We haven't had the statewide business property tax for very long. I think that it was 2001 that we put the statewide business property tax in place. We got by without it for many, many years, and it seems that that was just one more way that we grew the size of government, was to reach in where the local governments actually had complete authority over local property taxes, and the state said, well, we want some of that too. And so we decided that we would reach in and grab revenues out of our growing businesses and pull them into the state for more spending. So I would appeal to members of the House to consider the Senate's position. It was very well thought out. We had a lot of testimony in the Senate, including some of the folks here today, that persuaded us that the place to start, like, there are many things we could do for you, Mr. Wise, and Senator Rosen, you may be right, there are lots of things we'd like to do, but the Tax Committee has it within its power to recommend the repeal of the statewide business property tax, and I would ask members to seriously consider joining us with that priority as a place to start.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for the testifiers? Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I feel really good because the governor and Senator Ortman and Chair Davids all want to reduce business property taxes. So you're in first place, I think, so far in the debate this year. And I mean that all in very genuinely. I think it's really good that the three groups here recognize the problem. And I know Mr. Masha and Mr. Wise and Ms. Rakow, it's been great working with all of you over time, and you do a really great job trying to educate legislators that really the biggest tax you pay is the property tax. I mean, we spent a lot of time here talking about S-Corps and C-Corps, and as Senator Ortman just said, that's some portion. But the big kahuna is the property tax, and I think the testimony about that Ms. Rocco just said that Senator Ortman just echoed, which is, whether you make money or not, no matter what's going on, you're paying this tax. And so I think that's a good starting point. I will recall, and I listened to Representative Anderson, not ask you questions, but the commissioner instead, talking about the governor's position on this. And I was just reading his veto letter of House File 130. And he did cite his concern about that bill raised business property taxes. So I think you've got a friend there, and you've got a friend here in the legislature. So I think that's a good start. I guess my question really is, the way I think about these business property taxes and I know that some of you know, I've thought about them a lot. The state business property tax, as the chair stated, is new. It grows slower, though, and is more stable than the local business property tax. And I think for most of your businesses, when you look at the taxes you're paying, the state business property tax, and to the locals, you're actually paying more to the locals. So that's kind of the bigger slice, what you're paying to the counties and to the cities and to the Met Council and to everybody under the sun. And I think that's what Commissioner Franz is talking about. Governor is trying to rein that in, and that's where the real big pressure is, and it's growing fast. The state tax, business tax, is actually still not popular, and you don't like it. I understand that. But it's not growing as fast, and it is more stable. And I wonder if your all the folks you represent have sort of thought about these two, not as one, not just as these are our business property taxes, but that different sets of property taxes are going on, and what your thoughts are about that, because both of the bills here in the House and Senate, the House bill, and I know this is something that, Ms. Rocco, you maybe have a lot of work in, and I know you do a great job with your board, and I've watched you, but it is difficult to get people to understand the market value homestead credit, and in the House bill, that's being converted to a net tax capacity. And in the Senate bill, there's something else going on. I haven't quite figured all that out yet, but that also will wait. Both of those provisions will raise your business property taxes. And often, of course, your business owners are busy making parts. They're not thinking about this. But, so we have a lot going on in all these bills where, the governor's doing something to hold your property taxes down. Senator Ortman is, Representative Davids is. But there's also provisions that are raising your business property taxes simultaneously. And as the three go down the road together, have you thought about the market value credit piece, the state business property tax relief, and the local business property tax relief, and kind of where your members might all be at the end of the day? I mean, I know you want property tax relief, and I think everybody supports you in that. How will you weigh all those different competing issues out? Because I do think the market value homestead credit piece raises every business's property taxes, and I think you have to bring that into the discussion.
Ms. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, I'll tell you what, Minnesota's property tax system is so incredibly complicated. And this gives me an opportunity to say I think we should can this tax capacity notion. I mean, it's so complicated. And we sit, and actually we do have a task force of NIAP members that are sitting right now, and we have for the last 18 months, and trying to understand the intricacies of all of this. And we're all reasonably smart people. We've spent a lot of time. We've had people from House Research, the League of Minnesota Cities. We've had city managers and mayors come in and talk with us. And it's really, really hard to understand all of this. And I would love to see this property tax system simplified. And I do not understand, but I will try to get at the heart of why we put this tax capacity thing in the first place. All it does is confuse people. And I'm not going to say right now why I think that was done because I'm not 100% sure. But it is very difficult, Representative Lincheski, to weigh all of the things you're talking about. It's incredibly complicated. It is much easier for us as a group to understand and focus on the state general tax because of that. And it represents anywhere from 23, and I just read something from in Bloomington, I think it's about 27 or 28% of a business owner's property tax in Bloomington. And so that is a significant chunk, and quite frankly, it is easier for us to focus on that because the rest of it is so complicated. But we're trying. We are working at it, and we've got some thoughts and ideas, but we're not quite there yet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, I don't have a further question. I'll just say that I am really optimistic that Senator Ortman and the chair and the governor are taking this issue very seriously. I think your organization has helped, I'll be honest, folks on my side of the aisle understand why business taxes matter and why they're, and that business property taxes are regressive. And we ought to have an interest in helping in this regard. So I do think it's complicated. I think your group does an excellent job, and I've had the opportunity to work with all of you, and you have a lot of work ahead of you still with everybody here before the end of the day, but I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Ursula Lincheski. We'll go to Senator Ortman and then Senator Senjum, and then I'd like to move on. We've got a full agenda here unless there are other questions. Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, I agree with Representative Lincheski that it can be complicated for businesses to sort out who's charging the taxes and what benefits you're getting for those taxes, and I think it's incumbent upon us to create more simplicity in our tax structure and more transparency so that you can see the benefits that you're receiving and paying for. In 2001, Representative Lencheski, we passed the market value credit. I wasn't here. I know I look a little older than that, but I wasn't here. I was a county commissioner at the time in 2001. And since we passed that market value credit, Representative Lencheski, it was funded 1 year out of 10. And so whatever fully funded, right, I think we're down to, 30% in the last biennium it was funded. And so whatever shifting has been done locally, it's been done. And so what we're trying to do is fix it by coming clean with our local communities and saying, all right, we aren't paying for it, so why are we insisting that you put a credit on the property tax statements when the legislature isn't paying for it? And so I think what we're doing is improving the transparency and the simplicity so you can see more clearly what your local elected officials do in terms of spending and taxation. And I would remind the members that we don't raise local property taxes from St. Paul, and we certainly don't spend and adopt budgets locally. And so to the extent that folks are trying to maybe blur the lines here and say that we're raising local property taxes in whatever bills we have before us is just a falsehood. We weren't elected to raise local property taxes, and not one of the bills before us, the House or the Senate, raises local property taxes. And so I think we should just be mindful of that. We don't have the authority to do it. The folks at home do that. They're elected to do it. They have full responsibility and authority. And, in fact, they've done it very responsibly. They have not raised local property taxes significantly. I think they're dealing with the same downturn that everybody is dealing with the fact that market values are dropping and more folks are unable to pay their local property taxes because of foreclosures and vacancies and things like that. That's what they're struggling with. And I think we should also be mindful of the fact that the economy will not recover until our businesses grow. And so locals and state officials alike are all going to have to work together to cut spending because we have more government than we can afford. And that's as much a message to the governor as any. We have to cut the spending. And I think we can count on our local elected officials to do that. And I hope we won't mix up the message and suggest that we do that here in St. Paul, because we don't.
Thank you, Senator Irvin. Senator Senjum, and then we'll move on. Senator Senjum.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just a question, or at least a comment directed towards our commissioner. Thank you for being here this morning. And what you said, I suppose I've heard 1,000 times, but when you said it this morning, it kind of struck me, and that is this whole notion that the antidote, if you will, to business property taxes is LGA. And so I'm sitting here thinking, well, if that's the antidote, how good an antidote is it? And can it really work? Can it really sustain itself? And then we've got statewide business property taxes on one hand, and we charge businesses those, and then we try to buy it back with LGA, and it just seems like a convoluted system that could probably never work very well. And so my question, my comment to the commissioner is, do you just think it's time to kind of think all this system that we've gotten into over the course of obviously many years, and I'm not going to lay blame to anybody, but we've got this system where we're always trying to fix things, but we never quite do it. And I'm just not altogether sure that LGA in and of itself is the redeeming grace, if you will, to this business property tax issue. Seems like we got to go deeper than that. And I don't know, I'd just like to get your thoughts, because I don't think it's working.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, well, thank you for your concern. Clearly, as we've talked about today, the need to put to reduce the pressure on ever-increasing property taxes for everybody, personal residences and businesses, is something we all agree on that we have to do. The citizens of this state, the businesses of this state, have been heavily burdened by the property tax system, and the governor's position is supportive of trying to alleviate that concern. And I also want to thank these folks for coming today to testify about this. But with respect to your question, Senator, it's one of these situations where I can truly say I didn't dream up this property tax system. And if I had to start all over, I hope it wouldn't end up like the one that we have. Clearly, there are ways that we can reform, and I know that some of us have had various discussions about reform. Senator Ortman and I have, and Chair Davids and I have, about the need to engage in real reform to make the system understandable. I mean, it's true that the more opaque the system is, the less you can figure out what unit of government is getting that slice of the pie and why they're raising that slice the way that they do and where is their money going. The more that that is transparent, the more that people will feel comfortable making those payments. I agree with that idea. So the difficulty, obviously, is now. How do we adjust those kinds of complex issues that you're raising? How do we adjust those now? And I don't have the answer for that. I'm certainly more than willing and happy to engage in ideas about how to reform it, how to present it in a way that will make more sense. And we're not saying, by the way, Senator Sinjum, that the LGA is the solution, but we are saying it's a way to avoid compounding the problem. So the governor's position on LGA is that's not the by not making cuts to LGA, that's not the solution to the ultimate problem, but it does stop the bleeding, if you will. And so with respect to your willingness to engage in really serious discussions about reform or changing the system, we're here at any time to do that. And I think that's a goal that all of the citizens and all the businesses would ultimately appreciate if we could make a little bit more simple system. So we're happy to engage in that at any time, Senator.
Senator Sinjum?
Thank you. And just the other kind of passing thought I had, and I would defer to some of my more suburban colleagues, but if LGA was even part of the answer, and it may help a business out in Olivia, but it seems to me, and I'll stand corrected, that a lot of our business base in Minnesota is, in fact, in this suburban ring that, in fact, probably doesn't get a lot of LGA, at least on a per capita basis. And so you're kind of hanging out there alone. We can say LGA might help a little bit, but I don't think it helps a lot of our suburban business bases. And I'll stand corrected on that.
I think it helps in this market value credit.
Thank you, Senator. We do need to move on by Anderson and Runbeck. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. You're right, Senator Sinjum. You know, in my district that I come from, Plymouth, Medicine Lake, they do not receive one dime of local government aid. So that doesn't help the businesses in my community at all. And, you know, I think the comment that struck, I'll just leave it at that, just to be brief. So, yeah, you are correct.
Briefly, Representative Runbeck, then we're
yes,
going to move
thank
on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wise mentioned something. I think we're in the third year now of declining property values, and yet we have had increasing tax capacity rates. And my concern is, I wonder, Kay, Ms. Rakow, if you would be able to generate maybe the property values, property tax statements, maybe from these gentlemen, a couple of them anyway, at the pre-recession levels. What were those high property value rates that you had? Okay, because now we've got a much higher tax capacity that's, you know, it's been increasing. And so once your business gets back to the pre-recession valuations, boom. You know, there's a big surprise awaiting a lot of folks. So I just would like to kind of get a handle on, you know, what happens when the valuations go back to their highest levels. Because at the current tax capacity rates, it's going to be a real shock, I think. But perhaps you can just help us.
Ms. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'd be more than happy to get that information for you.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Ms. Rakow, Mr. Wise, and Mr. Masha. We'll now go on to Mr. Hesse from the Chamber. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your testimony this morning. Mr. Hesse. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First, thank you for inviting me here this morning. I can't say anything more about the property tax than these folks have already said, but we appreciate both the House and the Senate addressing the statewide property tax in your respective tax bills. It is a tax of concern. I think if you ask, a variety of businesses, what tax they care about most, you'll probably get different answers depending on what type of business they are and what situation they're in. Some will care a lot about the property tax. Some will care a lot about the corporate income tax. Others, the personal income tax, as was mentioned here earlier, and still others, the sales tax. So I think you do have to look at business competitiveness as sort of almost a menu of items and try to figure out which taxes are the biggest problems, and then try to focus and try to address those over time. So, when you look at the state's national rankings with respect to the variety of taxes that businesses pay, certainly property taxes are among the highest. I think they, as Ms. Rockow said, in the top 10 for commercial property of various types and locations. So that is certainly one that is on our list of taxes that need to be addressed. Similarly, the corporate income tax, I think everybody knows we have a relatively high rate, third or fourth highest, depending on if you include D.C. And even if you look at the corporate income tax per capita per thousand of income, we are around top 10 nationally with respect to the corporate income tax collections nationally. And I think most folks know that we have high personal income tax collections in the state as well. There were the national rankings that, according to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, hover around 6th, 7th or so, depending on if you're per capita, per thousand of income. So, again, those areas are areas that we believe need to be addressed. So with respect to the bills that are in front of the committee or in conference committee, as I said, the statewide property tax, we appreciate the reduction or the phase out. It is the lever that the state has to directly impact business property taxes without negatively impact other property types. If you reduce classification rates for business property, you shift burden to everybody else. The statewide property tax is the direct lever that you have to reduce business property tax burden in Minnesota, and if that is the goal, I think that's the best goal or the best vehicle to address the property tax burden of businesses. Couple of other features of the bill that I'll comment on, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Research and development credit, the bump in the research and development credit in the House bill, certainly appreciated the. We made lots of progress last year on a bipartisan basis, increasing the R&D credit. We believe the R&D credit works to mitigate the state's 9.8% corporate income tax rate. It works well with the foreign royalty deduction to keep high wage jobs, research and development, high technology jobs in Minnesota. And so, again, bumping up the R&D credit a little bit more will just help that sector of Minnesota's economy improve over time. The upfront exemption on capital equipment purchases, another piece that is in the House bill, not until 2014, but it's a frustration factor for many, many businesses that when they purchase their capital equipment, they have to pay the tax and then wait 6 months or so to get their refund of the sales tax that they paid. We appreciate the governor's suggestion and the legislature passing, governor signing the elimination of the refund delays. That was maybe even more of a frustration than the refund process itself, just knowing that the refunds were going to be delayed even further. But I think over time, if you convert that exemption to that refund program to an upfront exemption, you will give more small businesses capital quickly. They won't have to finance the tax themselves. I had one businesswoman call me when her refund was delayed and said, "You mean I have to wait until July 1 in order to get my $22,000 that I could be using for other things in my business?" And I had to say yes. But again, thank you for taking care of that for her and for others. And then finally, the personal income tax, just maybe brief comments there. Again, the businesses that are organized as S-Corps, LLCs, partnerships flow their business income through their personal return. So we do always watch personal income taxes as well, both because it's a business tax and because it's a recruitment issue. Businesses do often look at the rate schedule, and if you have high personal income tax burdens, it often costs you more to recruit, high-level executives to Minnesota from other states. So I think you're touching on a lot of the tax issues that are concerns for our members. But again, you know, each individual business will have their different story about which tax is most important to them. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Questions from conferees?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
If I could, I want to just ask our page to hand out a recent article from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal with the headline dated Wednesday, April 20th. Minnesota ranks last in study of state business taxes. It lists all of them, and I think it follows well on the previous testifiers. The entire climate is not very business-friendly. In fact, it's anti-competitive. And if you look at the list of where we come out compared to our neighbors and the rest of the states in all of our taxation, it shows that we are failing in terms of the business tax index this year. We have to address these issues. We have to start somewhere. And Mr. Hesse's right. They together, it's creating a choke on growth in business in Minnesota, and it's up to us this year to get something done here to address these concerns. So just wanted to make sure members had a copy of this recent article.
Thank you, Senator Orban. And for members, there's a background paper from the Tax Foundation that I passed out. I did not get my name on there, so I apologize. That is from me. When we have handouts, we like to have who they're from on there, so that one was from me. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hesse. I wanted to ask you, I mean, we talk about this a lot with the proposal that the governor's put forward and proposals that are in the House and the Senate tax bills and that, and a lot of discussion before this committee about how our tax climate affects the business community, affects our job climate and that, and kind of about what's too much. I mean, at what point are we pushing businesses out of the state to seek, you know, a friendlier business climate and that. And you know, how would you assess kind of where we're at and what the future may hold for our business community if we looked at proposals such as what the governor's put forward for our future? I just, you know, and we probably talked about this before I got here, and so I apologize if there was a long discussion, but, you know, a lot of states are moving away from that trend and trying to either reduce their corporate taxes, reduce their personal income taxes, and some states who have gone sort of the higher tiers, getting at the wealthier folks, have really seen those proposals backfire. They didn't bring in the money they anticipated. So how would you assess where we're at and what the future may hold?
Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, a couple of thoughts. First, I think business, you know, as I said earlier, you can't kind of put every business into the same category. So there are some businesses that certainly will tolerate Minnesota's tax burden, and they have, and they're used to it, and they don't like it, but they'll tolerate it. There's another segment of businesses that are very tax sensitive, and you know, increases in burden will have some impact on their locations. And when we asked members early in the year about some of the proposals that we were seeing, you know, we heard from, for example, an S-Corp bank concerned about the impact of a new fourth bracket on their ability to retain capital within the bank, and then the ability to loan more money and get that back out into the economy. We heard from a relatively new business that was on the verge of securing a national contract that would significantly be able to expand their business and go from two employees up to you know, many dozen employees. The person's thoughts were if there was the proposals were to become law, they would probably expand outside of Minnesota. So, you know, just a couple of examples of the potential negative consequences of you know, of going at least to more tax-sensitive employers to you know, increasing burdens from their current level.
Thank you. And just another kind of track along those lines. You know, I think, well, I don't know this, but you know, in my opinion, I think some studies have shown this, that really corporate taxes are regressive because those taxes are passed on to to consumers and really does also affect wages for businesses. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I think you're correct. I think I've seen some studies that suggest the corporate income tax really gets passed on in the form of lower wages to individuals more than through to prices. But again, yes, I think you're correct that it is regressive and tends to reduce wages in Minnesota.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go on to Mr. Hickey. I know that there's several folks have a press conference coming up here. So
thank you,
Mr. Hesse, and all members can certainly contact Mr. Hesse, doing a fine job representing the chamber anytime they'd like to. Mr. Hickey, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thanks for having me in this morning. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I thought I'd hit just some of the high points in the House and Senate bill and maybe address some of the issues in the email. Would that sound good? I want to thank both you and Senator Ortman for the tax bills you put together. You've really addressed a lot of the major problem issues that we have. As many of you know, we're the largest small business group and the largest group in terms of entities, also with about 13,000 small businesses across the state. Really want to thank Senator Ortman for putting in the provision on the estate tax relief for farms, qualified farms and small businesses. This is a real issue and a real problem for family-held businesses, and I think it's something we all cherish and we're real proud of, trying to keep traditions going in family-held businesses and farming, and traditions that can be very important to a lot of local economies, as you all know. And so we really appreciate that. I think the best we're going to get from the federal government is about a two-year moving target, and so Representative Lachesky was trying to work with us on this years ago, and the tax was moving around, the exemptions were moving around, the rates were moving around, and it was all quite unstable, I think would be the best way to say it. And we have a two-year target now, and so I think that's, appreciate you, Senator Ortman, putting that critical provision in. And, Mr. Chairman, you authoring it, although it didn't quite make it into the House bill, but you authoring it and caring about it. Really appreciate the phase-out of the statewide property tax, as we've heard a lot of discussion about. I've looked at some filings. It's about 20% to 30% of people's property taxes. That's a huge amount, and it is the one that you can directly control. And so that would be very helpful. Minnesota still ranks high on all the different analysis we've seen regarding property taxes and where we sit, despite our 01 reform. And Mr. Chairman, there are other good provisions in the House bill trying to give some individual income tax relief. We appreciate that, and also the provision on the purchase of capital equipment, making it an upfront exemption. Rebates don't work for a lot of people. A lot of people just give up on it. They don't follow through, and it's a little more important than a consumer rebate, but I'm sure there's taxpayers that just did not follow through on getting the rebate on the purchase of their capital equipment. It might have depended on how expensive the equipment was. The more expensive, maybe they did follow through. But making an upfront exemption would be very helpful to small businesses or any business that buys expensive equipment. I did want to jump into the email questions, and I think the elephant in the room clearly is the income tax proposal that the governor's put out there that we're strongly opposed to. We're encouraged he dropped the surtax. It was almost unbelievable. I don't think it was taken seriously, frankly. I didn't take it seriously. But at 10.95%, it's still a very damaging proposal to the Minnesota economy. Would we just be a sliver behind? I believe – I don't have my all my analysis with me this morning, but I think we'd put us number two, just slightly behind Oregon. Maybe somebody can verify that if I'm wrong. But that is not the answer for Minnesota in this bad economy. It's not the answer for a state that's had a reputation of having really high taxes for a long time to move up to just slightly below number one at number two with the 10.95% rate. If that was to occur, hypothetically, I can't imagine that the capital gains tax could get decoupled from that. So Minnesota would be sitting there with the second highest income tax rate by a hair, and we'd have about the same thing, I believe. I don't have my analysis with me today, but I think we'd be a very near second on capital gains. And you just really couldn't send a worse signal to entrepreneurs, the people we're looking to make things happen in the economy. Who's affected by proposals like this? People who are successful, who are growing jobs and are making something happen today, or the guy who just laid off a lot of people and made no money on his business last year. Clearly, the people who are creating jobs are making a profit and are the people we're looking to lead us out of this bad economy. So they're all really affected by that. And just one other thing I want to share briefly with you before I started answering questions was I did go to a meeting of the Small Business Caucus over in the House about a year and a half ago, put together by Representative Dietrich and Representative Dowdy, and it was a real stark look at how bad our investment climate is and how bad our venture climate is, our venture capital climate. We have really slipped. I thought Minnesota was very good on venture capital and on trying to find money for startups, and we have really slipped, and the experts who came in really sounded a warning alarm to us that we need to lower our capital gains tax, need to lower our corporate tax. It'd be nice to lower the individual income tax because it's usually, you know, tied directly to the income tax, and it was a real stark warning that Minnesota has really slipped in this area, and we're going to feel it. We're going to feel it in the small business sector. So just thanks for the time to speak this morning.
Thank you very much, and I must chastise someone. We have two more papers sent out with no names on them. These are from Representative Lencheski. We really need to get names on these. Who are these from? Oh, they're from me. Really not that big a deal. I just wanted to point out I sent out 2010-2011. We need to get our numbers turned around a little bit because it looks, if you read these, we're going in the wrong direction. So. I'll work on getting my name on those, just so you know these two are for me. Representative Lencheski and then Senator Artman. Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hickey, for being here. You referenced the email questions. I don't know what those are. Maybe they are proprietary between the chair and you. And so if they're not, I mean, maybe we could get a copy later. I don't know what questions you're responding to in the room. But I did want to – can you clarify? I was confused by what you said about – the income tax changes as proposed, not in these bills, but in the governor. Thank you. The decoupling of the capital gains, are you saying that if a rate goes up, Minnesota will never have an incentive? I was confused by your testimony
on
capital gains.
Representative Lencheski, my point was most states tax capital gains and what their individual income tax rates are. So if we jump up to 10.95% and do something that controversial hypothetically and put that kind of burden on working families, I really doubt this the legislature that did that. At the same time, would say, oh, we can't do this to investors. We can't do this to the guys at the investment houses and whatnot. We have to have a lower rate for them. So I'd really be surprised if that hypothetically occurred, that you'd have a lower capital gains rate. And it would be right up there at 10.95 too, and I think we'd have second highest in the country. And I don't think there's the worst thing you could do right now.
Russell and Chester.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to understand it. And you know, Minnesota's never followed the Feds on that issue, and you know, the new Bush Obama tax cuts that were agreed to by Congress carrying through. You know, Minnesota's still different. So I understand your point now. I was just kind of confused by what you were saying there. So appreciate that.
Representative Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Commissioner Franz, I've looked in the governor's proposal, and I haven't seen much evidence of a concern for competitiveness. There are lots of ideals, policy goals for tax policy. It could be we've talked about transparency. We've talked about simplicity. The governor has uber-focused on regressivity. We've heard him talk about it. However, I haven't seen any evidence. Where would I find any evidence in the governor's proposal that he's even considered the competitiveness of our business climate and our tax climate compared to other states? I don't see any evidence of it, and I'd sure like you to point me to some.
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, well, thank you for the question. Clearly, the idea of competitiveness is very important to the governor. One of the things that when we started talking about trying to put together the proposed budget and the tax bill, it included ways to make not only the revenue stream more stable for the state of Minnesota. Part of what we want to do for competitiveness is to make sure that we get out of this budget crisis every year that we have to come back up here and solve another budget crisis. So part of the goal is to be more competitive in making sure that the Minnesota economy and the fiscal economy of the state is more stable. And one of the ways to do that is to both cut make serious spending cuts, but also to make serious revenue improvements into the revenue stream. So the idea of being competitive is both gauged on a stable fiscal environment for the state, also part of the idea for the corporate tax provision and eliminating the provisions, the special tax provisions for the FOC and the foreign royalty was to broaden the base so that all income is taxed at more of the same rate in the state of Minnesota. Those particular provisions really enhance and benefit more out-of-state corporations than in-state corporations. So once again, the idea was trying to promote fairness for the corporate tax code, promote stability for the overall revenue stream for the state of Minnesota, and also to promote competitiveness in terms of making sure that all states are competing on an equal footing in the state. The R&D proposal was one of those issues that the governor agrees with some of the provisions in the House bill regarding increasing the credits for R&D. We believe that is one way to help make Minnesota companies have a more competitive advantage in Minnesota by providing a credit for Minnesota activities. One of the things, as we talk about competitiveness that we often hear about, and I appreciate Mr. Hickey's comments about small businesses and the tax rates, but one of the things we often don't talk about is the effective tax rate. I mean, we can all look at the statutory rate is important. We're not denying that it's not important, and it does have an influence on businesses, and they look to the statutory rate. But one of the things I was just studying recently, a report put out by Ernst & Young, a week or so ago, by Ernst & Young in April 2011, talks about the competitiveness of states vis-a-vis investments in new businesses and retention of jobs in different states. I'd just like to talk a little bit about that, because Ernst & Young ranked states based on how competitive their state and local taxes were with respect to other states. And they looked at the effective tax rate. They didn't look at just a statutory rate. So as we all know, and as Mr. Hickey knows, when a business decides to expand or to move, they look at what taxes they're actually going to pay, not on the statutory rate. So they have to analyze what are the real estate taxes going to be, what are the income taxes going to be. And as we all know, the tax codes are very complex, and there are a lot of definitional issues, there are a lot of qualification issues. So you really have to look to what is it that the company is going to actually pay. Well, one of the things that E&Y asked in their study was, how do you compare one state's current business tax system to another state in terms of investment? And Ernst & Young rated Minnesota 10th overall nationally with respect to comparing to other states. This study focused on new investments. One of the things that we're all concerned about and we all agree on is we want more jobs, we want people to move and invest in Minnesota, and we want to keep people here. We all agree on that. And one of the things that Ernst & Young studied in its report was how do businesses, when they go out and look at where to invest in new jobs, where to invest in new capital, what do they look to in terms of deciding where to make those investments? Well, the study looked at where do new companies put headquarters, R&D facilities, where do they put, you know, these call centers, where do they put durable and non-durable manufacturing facilities? And all of these, in terms of looking at the effective tax rate of the different states, found that Minnesota compared very favorably to other states. Now, the report is interesting also because I think it describes some of the issues that you're concerned about, Senator Ortman, and that is, what does a business look to determine whether a state is competitive or not? One of the things they look to, clearly, are the statutory rates, but they also look at the effective rate. They look at transportation. They look at utility costs. They look at where are their customers located. And we've all heard this in other testimony before these committees. They look to where is the correct trained workforce. Where can they find workers who are educated, who are trained to supply the necessary jobs? As Mr. Hickey, I'm sure, would agree, any small business or any business is really successful based on its employees, its workforce. That's the real super ingredient for any business to succeed. So the Ernst & Young study took a look at how does a business analyze where to invest, where to grow jobs. And they looked at, like I said, all these non-tax costs, and then they looked at the effective tax costs at the state and local level. And this study concluded quite favorably for Minnesota that overall we rank 10th with respect to other states. So the governor's bill is trying to make sure that we don't lose ground. It's trying to make sure that we do a bill that provides stability, fairness, and an overall competitive environment for the state of Minnesota. So, Senator, that's how the governor is trying to be very concerned about competitiveness.
Senator Ortman.
With all due respect, I think it's great that the governor read the report. I hope he'll look at page 11, which says that effective tax rates is a good place to begin the analysis of competitiveness, but it's no end to the issue. And I would say you've got a whole pile of reports that show that Minnesota is at the bottom of competitiveness, and I can't see any evidence in the governor's proposal that he even cares or is concerned. His proposal is about raising more money, more revenues. But he hasn't, even if he wanted to spread out the burden in terms of corporate taxes by eliminating FOCs, he didn't reduce the rate. It's just about raising more revenue so he can increase more spending. That's not competitive at all. And I hope you'll share these handouts with the governor. Put David's name on there, if you would. But share them with the governor, because I'm very concerned that he is not concerned about the same things that Minnesotans and Minnesota businesses and the legislature is concerned about, competitiveness, because that's where the economy will grow.
Okay, thank you, Senator Ortman. Representative Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Mr. Hickey to responding to some of the concerns that I had. I'd asked some questions about how the governor's proposal on personal income tax is going to impact our small businesses, our mom and pop shops, and I'm really concerned about that, because when it comes to small businesses, they are the fuel to our state's economic engine. And so when I look at the governor's proposal, I just see that as a job killer and just an economic killer to the state as a whole. And I appreciate the chair providing these articles. You know, I'm looking at both the 2010 and the 2011 business tax Small Business Survival Index, and what struck me was in the 2010 one, we're looking at here an increase in state and local tax burdens equal to 1% of personal income, reduced income growth by more than 3.5%. And for our state to try to increase more taxes on our small business owners, our mom and pop shops, that's a job killer, that's an economic killer for the state of Minnesota. And we can't afford to lose any more than what we're already losing. And, you know, when I look at this, I appreciate that the commissioner is looking at different measures. But these two studies alone look at, in the 2010, they had 38 measures that they looked at. In the 2011 study, they looked at 18 measures. Let me list them off for you. They've got the state's personal income tax rate. They've got the capital gains tax rate, the corporate income tax rate, the corporate gains tax rate, any added income tax on S-corps, whether or not state imposes alternative minimum tax on individuals. The list goes on and on. It's got property taxes on there. It's got the sales and gross receipts and excise taxes. It covers the gamut of everything that we experience in this state and how it impacts our businesses here. And we went from 42 to 50. The chair is right. We are going in the wrong direction. We're sending the wrong message to our businesses in the state, in particular our small businesses. And that really concerns me. And I understand your frustration, Mr. Hickey, and I would be concerned too. And, you know, when we're talking, you had mentioned the workforce, that's also a factor. You know, I agree. But we heard today earlier from our NIOC folks, from Steve Wise, small business owner, how his workforce, he's having problems finding machinists. They had to look at North Dakota. That's where he's looking for his workforce. So to say that Minnesota is in a top 10, I think that all of these articles that we've seen so far, you know, tell a different story. We truly have a lot of work to do, and I appreciate you coming forward and helping us see how we can fix those problems.
Okay. A brief comment there. We need to excuse you because I know you've got to be somewhere else. Not because we don't love you and want you here, but...
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Well, Senator Anderson, yeah, I strongly agree with your point. And I think we're probably the most income tax affected or sensitive group, because so many small businesses now are flow through. And our national office is 75%. Governor Plenty said 90%. It's a really high number. I think one thing that will surprise people if they really delve into this is how big some of these sub-S companies are. You'd say, oh, that's got to be a C corp. I can't imagine they're doing it sub-S. They have 400 employees. They have $20, $30 million in revenue. They're bigger and bigger companies are doing this. And I thought during the debate over the Bush tax cuts, trying to keep that top rate down, I thought Representative Ryan had said half or some huge percentage of the small business income in the country is going to be affected by that. So, you know, maybe it's certainly not the, you know, the majority in that bracket that was being debated about in the federal law, but it was a lot of income, you know, it was a lot of jobs, and it's a lot of, and more importantly, it's people who are making something positive happen now, not people on the bottom of the small business sector who are laying people off and taking no income or taking a modest amount of income. And so there's a lot of activity going on in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And Representative Loon, I guess, had a question. Senator Chamberlain, if they're directed, Mr. Hickey, you got, what, 2 minutes maybe?
I do.
Minus 2 minutes. Representative Loon.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, it was a comment really more to the commissioner and talking about the Ernst & Young study, because I think actually Representative Anderson kind of pointed this out. I mean, different studies can look at different things with regards to our business climate. But as Mr. Hickey pointed out, you know, most of our small businesses and maybe even some that are a little bit bigger do not pay the corporate tax, and that Ernst & Young study did not look at personal income tax rates, and that is most definitely a component that affects a significant portion of our business community, and even some of our very large Fortune 500 companies started as small businesses in this state. So, you know, I think a cautionary note for members that leaving that very important factor out would lead me to conclude that perhaps that really is not a full snapshot of what's going on.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Senator Chamberlain?
It's the same thing. It's more directed at Commissioner Franz, but
okay, I will excuse you. Thank you, Mr. Hickey, for your testimony.
You.
Senator Chamberlain.
You had mentioned something interesting that I had come across in the last few weeks, stability of revenue. California, deep study data analysis, about half of their state income tax was revenue came from the top 1 or 2% of the income earners in that state. So that's half of their income tax revenue. Well, there's a problem with that. When the economy went south, their income dropped 4 times greater than the rest of the population. So if you talk about stability in revenues, the suggestion from several studies lately, most recently, indicate, or they prove, that if you keep doing that and rely more and more heavily on those top 1 to 5% brackets, and sure they should pay their amount of tax, you're going to create more instability in the revenue stream and more trouble with the budget. So I'd like your comments on that. And secondly, I've gone through just 23 studies since 1985 that, I don't know, they don't come to the same conclusion the governor does. I don't know where taking more money from individuals and property owners and job creators is good for anybody. You know, if you take more money out of my pocket, I can't buy a pair of shoes or, you know, go up to the cabin for that week. So I don't know where in the world the common person would decide that if I go into your pocket, take $100 out, we can grow the economy. I just transfer that somewhere else. But comments on that revenue stability, if you wouldn't mind.
Commissioner?
Chair Davids, Senator, thank you. You know, one of the concerns about stability that we all have, and I was actually doing my little homework reading the Budget Trend Study Commission that I'm sure some of you folks remember, that was January 12, 2009, about dealing with this issue about stability. How do we provide for a stable revenue stream so that we can do other fun things on some years instead of solving this budget crisis? And part of the issue, Senator, is that we are facing a serious budget crisis. And the governor's approach is trying to be balanced. And so he is making serious budget cuts, but he's also proposing some serious revenue increases. And the reason that we're trying to increase not just the income tax, but also expand the corporate base and also in some of the sales area, try to not expand the sales tax area, but try to make that area more fair, is to provide for a broader base which would enhance stability. There are other ways to increase stability on the revenue stream, and those are ideas that may get talked about at some point. But right now, the governor's position has been to try to stabilize the revenue stream for the next biennium by increasing the tax revenue in a way that we think will provide the necessary revenue to bridge these gaps in the budget. So it's all in the context of this budget crisis that we're dealing with these issues. But I appreciate the senator's concerns.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Senator. Okay, we will now go to a representative from the High Tech Association and Kent Worden from BOMA. If you could please join us. And then, members, just so we know, I'm looking at the clock right there, and the Senate, I believe, goes into session at 10. So I'd like to spend a little time with the representative from the High Tech Association.
Oh, 10:30?
Oh, relax. We're fine. High Tech Association and BOMA, if you could please state your names for the record and then who you represent, and we'll go with your testimony. Just so members know, who I have left on my list here are the two gentlemen at the table, Dr. John Spry for some comments, and then Jill Larson. Is Jill Larson here?
Yes.
She will be? Oh, she is. Hi, Jill. Okay. Please proceed.
Good morning. Peter Lindstrom from the Minnesota High Tech Association. Just wanted to comment for a minute on the research and development tax credit and to thank the governor and the Senate, or the House, for including the increase in the R&D tax credit. Minnesota was really a trendsetter. Back in the early 80s when Minnesota was the first state to create the R&D tax credit, and since then there's been several dozen states in the federal government that's followed suit. It's worked. We have 130 high-tech employees. We have 8,000 to 9,000 high-tech establishments, and these are fantastic jobs. $77,000 is the average high-tech wage in the state of Minnesota. That's 68% higher than the average private sector wage. And I would say that this is good public policy because it encourages companies to go the extra mile for research and development. As you can imagine, if they're working on 10 products, 8 are going to be failures, 1's going to be a single, and you hope that 1's going to be a grand slam. So this is reinvesting money back into that business to take that extra step. It's critical for companies of all sizes. We have 3M, which I recently heard, one-third of their sales come from products that have been developed in the last 3 years. One-third of their sales from products from the last 3 years. They have 6,000 scientists and engineers, about half in Minnesota, half across the world. IBM, 5,000 employees in Rochester today, this morning. IBM is celebrating in Rochester their 100th anniversary of being a company. They've been in Rochester since 1915, a long time. They're doing some fantastic R&D down there. 8% of all of IBM's patents, all of them, come from the Rochester facility. So, but it's not just the big companies, it's the small companies that are taking advantage of the R&D tax credit. I talked to a business leader about a month ago, small company, software company. And I should say it's not just the companies that have the white lab coats and the labs pouring chemicals. It can apply to other high-tech enterprises. Talked to a CEO of a small software company who said it was the R&D tax credit that made the difference for his company last year from being in the red to being in the black. There's another company, and I'd like to do a little show and tell, if it's okay, very quickly. A company in Edina called Recon Robotics. Just want to show you what some of these companies are doing here in Minnesota. They make this robot. It's called a Scout.
Mr. Lindstrom, you don't have any glasses, do you?
Any glasses?
Or coins?
I do not have any glasses.
Okay, you're fine.
It's called a Scout. This little guy right here has a camera, and it is used by SWAT teams and first responders. Here's the camera right here. So I said it's a robot. They actually call it a throwbot, and I'll show you why. Whoa. It's very rugged. Watch out, Mr. Chairman. You can throw it. And the SWAT team members or the first responders have this device where they can see exactly what's taking place.
It disappears, too. Oh, there it is.
And so they can throw it through a window in a hostage situation, or where someone, like last year or 2 years ago, someone in Burnsville was suicidal. They had barricaded themselves in a bathroom. The SWAT team in Burnsville threw this through a window and could see exactly what was going on. You can imagine a tornado or an earthquake where there's a building that's unstable. You can throw this in there, see if there's anybody hurt or needs assistance. So they've made 1,000 of these. They're in 30 different countries around the world. They're being used in Iraq and Afghanistan by our military. And the company is hoping to be profitable very, very soon. And I talked to the CEO yesterday, and he says he is very much looking forward to using the R&D tax credit. And now that the legislature made it refundable last year, which is fantastic, he hopes to use it very, very, very soon. So that's just one example, Mr. Chairman, about the type of R&D that this is being used for.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, if Mr. Griffin could join us here, too, we'll go to Mr. Ward, and we'll let the three testify, and then we'll go to member questions. Welcome to committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Kent Warden. I'm executive director of Greater Minneapolis BOMA. It stands for the Building Owners and Managers Association Commercial Real Estate Group, representing about 60 million square feet of office space in the Minneapolis and suburban area. About half of that is in downtown Minneapolis, which is, I think, generally considered to be the economic engine of the region, and so obviously very important from what I've been hearing before, in a competitive position, and clearly office location and expansion and so forth is becoming more of a global competitive issue, and I know you've been hearing that over and over, so I won't belabor that, but it is certainly true from our vantage point. I'm here today to thank you for including a reduction and eventual phase-out of the statewide commercial industrial property tax as part of your plan. Clearly that would help, and you obviously know the history of that, where we worked for years to get class rate compression. A lot of states just tax all property at the same rate. We were taxed much higher, finally got it down to 2-to-1 ratio to homes. But then that was deemed apparently either to be too generous or created other needs, so we added about half of the savings back in 2001 by way of the statewide CI tax. We didn't like the idea at the time, but it at least was kind of getting half a loaf in getting the tax rates down. So anything we can do to reduce that would be certainly appreciated. The 2-to-1 ratio with the statewide added to it really brought it up to about a 3-to-1 ratio, and I'll refer to a specific example in downtown Minneapolis. When you add the local multiplier, which in a central city and with its school district and so forth, brings the effective rate for that area up higher, it's really about 4% right now. So that's what we're dealing with. Again, there are a number of ways we can work on that, but the statewide CI tax elimination would certainly be a good one. I want to just talk to you about real numbers in terms of how that affects a specific building. It's a very nice, newer Class A building, 700,000 square feet in downtown Minneapolis. The current estimated market value by the assessor is $95 million, which is, to be honest, is quite a bit less than the current owner paid for it prior to the economic recession. So those values will probably be increased. But even at today's value, at a 4% effective rate, we're just an eyelash under $4 million a year that that building is paying. And I want to underscore that the owner doesn't pay the tax bill. The building is fairly fully occupied with all kinds of large and small tenants, and the tenants ultimately pay it. Of the $4 million, the statewide CI tax, according to the numbers we've run here, is about $930,000, so it is a significant part of that burden. As I indicated, there's a mix of tenants, but let's just take, for an example, a 5,000-square-foot tenant that might employ 15 to 20 people. Their share of the burden is going to be about $25,000. So these are real dollars. They do affect real businesses and need to be addressed. I do, while I thank you for working on the CI tax, the statewide CI tax issue, one other point that I would be remiss not to mention that has been raised by our members who are the downtown property owners and who have met with City Hall and city staff to get some handle on the impact of the LGA cuts. I know that's a sensitive issue, and certainly there'll be a lot of discussion about that. But in this specific building, that would raise the effective rate if the city only passed half of the LGA cut on to property taxpayers and cut through a variety of other things. I think that's kind of considered to be the low end of the range. That would impose an additional $200,000 burden on this specific building. So one more thing to think about, and I know you're confronted with a lot of very difficult decisions in the days ahead, but appreciate this opportunity for input.
Thank you, sir. Please state your name for the record who you represent, and then we'll go to, if Mr. Lindstrom, you might want to join us again because the members might have questions. If you could just stay right there.
Okay, sure.
Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I am representing Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley is Minnesota's trade association for the drug, device, and diagnostic industry. With over 600 life science firms, we employ nearly 50,000 Minnesotans. And I'm just here briefly today, Mr. Chairman, members, and Commissioner, to say thank you for the House provision related to R&D tax credits. We look at those as a real source of competitive advantage for Minnesota. It is something that the increases, as you've heard, are very good for the companies that we represent, and it is something where we are not competing against all 50 states. We're competing against a very small number of states that include states like California and North Carolina, Massachusetts, where these kinds of research activities are going on, and so we need to remain competitive in that area. We will never be the highest in giving out R&D tax credits, but we need to stay competitive in that area. And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to mention two other things that have been part of the discussion of the taxes that have gone on this session. One of them relates to the FOC provisions that have been proposed by the governor, and we would strongly urge you not to adopt those. You saw a letter, House Tax Committee members, from our organization. I'll be happy to share that with the rest of the conferees. But because of the unique aspect of the life science industry of starting a lot of our products overseas and then exporting those products as we come back to the United States for approval, that would have a very great disadvantage for our companies, and that would impact us far more negatively than perhaps many other kinds of manufacturing firms. And last but not least, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can't leave this committee without thanking you for the Angel Investor Tax Credit legislation, which you passed last year. It has had a great deal of impact. We have released a letter that I think a number of you have seen talking about the number of firms that have taken advantage of this. We now see our neighbors who are looking at our legislation as a model and feel that they are at a competitive disadvantage because of what you did last year. It is having an impact, and we really appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, members, those are the comments that I have today. If there are further questions, I'd be happy to make them, but I will not bring devices to throw at the chairman. If you'd like to have medical devices, we have great providers available to bring you back into the hospital, Mr. Chairman, and we'll work with you there.
But more importantly, when we passed that sheet out yesterday in tax committee, did I have my name on it?
Mr. Chairman, I believe you did.
Okay. Mr. Lindstrom, Mr. Warden, Mr. Griffin, questions from conferees?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Griffin. When you consider then these tax expenditures that your corporations are paying, I mean, do you have a, you know,
what is sort of the effective tax rate, maybe the impact? I mean, does it reduce their corporate taxes by half, or is there any way to really understand what their effective corporate income tax rate is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunbeck, I'm not sure that I have a specific answer for you. Our company's membership ranges all the way in size from companies like Medtronic with, you know, 136,000 employees or something like that worldwide, down to Epitopix and Wilmer with half a dozen employees. So the calculations that go into making these decisions vary all across the board. And that was one of the things that we talked about when Representative Lucheski and we were discussing what happens with the Angel Investor Tax Credit. The idea for some of the small companies of reducing corporate taxes really doesn't make any sense because they're not profitable and they're not paying any taxes right now, whereas you go to the other extreme and those other companies are making those kinds of calculations.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Griffin, could you get us a couple examples? I mean, real-life examples, you know, take the name off, but, I mean, just give us a sense of, you know, a fully loaded little company that's just starting out and using all the various tools we've given them, you know, how does that work itself out in terms of their corporate income tax rate versus maybe a large one, you know, that is especially the FOC version, you know, somebody who has started their product overseas and then now is bringing it back to market it. It would be very helpful just to see, you know, a real-life example.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, if I could ask that I go back to my staff and ask them to try and prepare something, we'll try and bring it back to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay. I have Senator Rosen and Senator. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Runbeck asked my first question, but my second question is for Mr. Lundstrom. And the House provision is for $58 million. 12 and 13 and 70 million ongoing. Is that competitive with the states that we are competing with? The Californias, the Michigans, the New Jerseys, Ohio's?
Mr. Chairman, it'll be a huge step in the right direction. There's probably 35 to 40 states that now have R&D tax credits, and they span the spectrum. It would probably put us more in the middle of the pack for the generosity of the different R&D tax credits.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, so Mr. Lindstrom, the companies that are thinking of relocating, this would give us a foot in the door. Is that what you're saying?
No question about it.
Mr. Lindstrom.
I see.
No question about it. And the point I would make here is that R&D is becoming much more fungible than it has been in the past. R&D used to be a done deal that it would take place someplace in the United States. Now we're seeing R&D take place in India, China, Brazil, you name it. The companies have options.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
Senator Senjum, then we will go to Dr. Spry. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just to try to get some general thoughts from you, being from where I am, I think I tend to understand at least the foundational strength of what we have in Minnesota, with certainly the University of Minnesota, Mayo, the Hormel Institute, Medtronic, and I don't want to leave anybody out, but we've got some outstanding research facilities and people in this state, and then IBM, you know, 8% of the patents of IBM coming out of Minnesota, and then all too often those discoveries at Mayo tend to find themselves going to other states for commercialization, and I don't know exactly where all those IBM patents go, but they tend to drift away, and we never really kind of completely grasp the you know, the value of that research from the standpoint of our state's economy. And I don't know if you have it, and maybe you've already kind of given us the answer, but, you know, how do we grasp that? How do we make Minnesota, and I personally believe if we talk about a new economy in Minnesota, we'd be foolish not to think of biotechnology, biosciences as being one of the major drivers for moving this state forward into a, if you will, a new prosperity. So if that's somewhat true, what do we need to do around this table to help make that happen?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Centrum, I think you've just said you're going to throw a nice big softball right across the middle of the plate, and I'm ready to hit it out of the stadium. 4 weeks ago in the State Capitol Rotunda, we had a press conference with the governor and legislative leaders to talk about BioVest. This is a company that is expanding in Coon Rapids, and it's doing so through a combination of efforts that the state has been a part of with the private sector, including the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. Indeed, they are in the finishing touches of their Phase 2 clinical trials to make a vaccine for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And it was their announcement at their press conference here that they were staying in Minnesota and expanding their manufacturing facilities in Coon Rapids because of the efforts that were put together by the state with the BioBusiness Alliance working with DEED to find funding with the city to make sure that they could build this new facility and employ Minnesotans. This is the kind of work that we need to continue to make these kinds of successes. This is a company that is headquartered in Georgia and that is doing this research here, and I think this is the kind of work that you have helped to facilitate and we need to just keep doing. And, you know, my first response to you is R&D tax credit is part of what is going to make companies like that go in the future. My second response is that the BioBusiness Alliance needs to continue its funding, which you have small parts of in bills but not completely, and you need to keep DEED out there so that they can keep working on these things. You need to have city development corporations and city development systems that are working. So I hope that helps to answer a little bit of it, but it's not just one single thing that helps those kinds of things go. And we can go back to what our legislative agenda talks about as our prime core value here, and that is we have to have an educated workforce. And you've been a part of making sure that we have those research facilities at the University of Minnesota and at the Minsky System and at the Mayo Clinic. And you don't want to leave anybody out, but you can go to St. Jude and Guidant, Boston Scientific, the bench researchers that they have there. It makes a community here that we need to continue to expand. We have a pretty good one in what's going on in the device industry, but we need to, as you say, bring in that bio world because that is going to be the next world. I hope that helps a little bit.
Senator Sinjim.
Mr. Chair, and maybe I can just offer, and I got to be a little careful here, but I know right now that our governor is in Rochester, Minnesota, visiting IBM, and it's part of their centennial celebration. And I also know that the whole issue of foreign operating corporations and the foreign royalties and all of that is just extremely, extremely important to their existence in Minnesota. And so when we have a tax bill offered up by the governor that pretty much does away with all that, then that concerns, frankly, me, because that's in my district and there are a lot of my people. But it ought to affect all, it ought to concern all Minnesota. We've just got to be more sensitive to these issues and what their implications might be. IBM is a giant in Minnesota. They're a giant, frankly, we all know it, in the world. And they do things in Rochester, Minnesota, and I don't want to be too parochial here, that are cutting edge, the largest, most fantastic supercomputers in the world are manufactured 80 miles down the highway. And it's just so important that we recognize that, we know that, and that rather than destroy it with tax implications which are going to hurt them, that we work to cultivate that. And going forward, we just have to. There's no choice. We grow or die, and my hope is we're going to grow.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Lindstrom, Mr. Ward, and Mr. Griffin. Representative Lynchester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say to Senator Sinjim, you just made a great argument for the House provision. I hope the Senate will take it. It's the House that's continuing on the R&D credit, and we have made great strides in the refundability and in expanding it. And the House is carrying this provision. The Senate is not. So, Senator Sinjim, I hope you'll work on Chair Ortman when she returns to accept Representative David's provision when we get down to the part of negotiating on it. And I wish Senator Ortman were here, and I know she's stepped out to a meeting. People are busy, and she'll return. But I do want to say that we had a discussion before, Mr. Chair and Senator Sinjim, that the bill on the TIF extension that you're carrying, and it's in the Senate bill, and the House is not carrying it, there, we got into this discussion about how do you create these research jobs. And really the TIF provision is not designed to do that. That's not what that bill's for. The research and development credit in the House bill will actually get these R&D jobs we want, because the way that the research and development credit is structured, and I believe it's our new legislator in our side of the in our body that is Representative Bills is carrying the bill. And, you know, the way that our R&D credit is structured now, and he's continuing that in this proposal that the Chair Davids is carrying, is, you know, what qualifies to receive this credit. And much of that is compensation for the people who do the research. And that is, this is the way to create R&D jobs. It is through the research and development credit. And as one who's carried it and proved it and did the angel credit, you know, I'm not a fan of tax credits. But I'll tell you about the research and development credit and why I'm such a strong supporter is it's the one that's got the proof that it actually works. It's one of the only tax credits that works. The rest of them all claim they do, but actually the data doesn't support it. And this one does, and I hope the Senate will get on board on the House's position on the R&D credit. I think it'll help Rochester. I hope you'll use your influence on Senator Ortman to join the House conferees.
Chair, Representative Lucheski. I know Representative Davids has never had a bad idea, so we'll give it due consideration.
Thank you, Senator Sanchez. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Chester, were you done?
Yep.
Okay, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I would have to agree with Representative Lucheski in part. I think this is a great statement for the House position on the R&D credit, but must respectfully disagree on the TIF provision and just point out this exciting project going on in Coon Rapids that we just heard about is actually one of those projects to be getting some assistance with local development through the TIF provisions that were put in last year, and they are one of those that testified strongly in favor of the extension. So, you know, there's a number of ways in which the public can partner with our private industry to bring great high-paying jobs into our state and to encourage that, and also honestly from a society benefit, all of the life-saving advances that are created that benefit people far and wide beyond Minnesota is something that I think we need to remember. So the TIF provision actually does affect some of these jobs too.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Any other questions from conferees? Okay, thank you, conferees. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Lindstrom, Ward, and Griffin. We'll now go to Dr. John Spry, and then we'll wrap up with Jill Larson. So, Dr. Spry, welcome to the Tax Conference Committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is John Spry, and I am a professor at St. Thomas, but I'm appearing to before you as a private citizen from St. Paul, and all errors are my own.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
And I believe you have a handout from House Research.
Who's it from? Oh, House Research.
Oh, it's
that's
from
okay.
House Research. And I was preparing to make some comments about tax competitiveness and effective marginal tax rates in historical perspective. And since the memo is from House Research, it might be better if they gave you a brief overview, and then I could add a couple comments to it.
Okay, members, you have the handout. It's supposed to be from Representative Loon. So please take the handout. No, actually, it's House Research. So they've got their name on it. Patrick J. McCormick, Director. Okay, Dr. Spry.
Well, I don't know if you wanted House Research to talk about memo or me.
Okay.
First.
With the memo here, okay. Ms. Manzi, if you could please present that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this memo was in response to a very specific request from Representative Banyan. You see that it's addressed to him, and he's shared it with the committee. He had done some preliminary research on effective tax rates, combined federal and state effective tax rates, on high-income wage earners. So this is not related to unearned income, capital income, but rather to wages and to self-employment income. He had a concept of marginal tax gradient, which he defined for us in doing the research as the top rate on a very high wage-earning person arrived at, the top state rate arrived at by taking the ratio of the top state rate in Minnesota to the rate that would be in effect in a state with no income tax. So it's really just the top state rate. he wanted presented in this historical table running from 1970 into 2015, the top federal statutory rate on wage income, the top Minnesota statutory rate on wage income, the combined top federal and state effective rate, and then this marginal tax gradient. The top, and then he wanted taken into account in developing this the effect of the federal deduction for state income taxes paid, which has the effect of reducing the top state rate, because when the state increases its rate on wages, that's allowed to be deducted at the federal level, so the actual cost to the taxpayer affected is less than the rate increase. It's the rate increase times one minus the top federal rate that applies, so it's a smaller portion. And then for the federal rate, from 1970 through 1986, taxpayers were allowed to deduct their federal taxes at the state level, so the top federal rate was lower than what was in the federal law because the state allowed deductions, so at that side it was the other way around. And those two things interacted since they were both in effect from 1970 through 1986, with taxpayers 85 and 86 were a little more complicated because there were two rate schedules available at the state level, with taxpayers having the option of either deducting federal taxes and paying a higher top state rate or not deducting federal taxes and then paying a lower state tax rate. So there's two entries on the table for 1985 and 1986. Also included in the combined top federal and state effective rate is the health insurance portion of payroll taxes, which since I believe 1991 has had no wage cap. So the 1.45% paid by both employees and employers for health insurance and their payroll taxes applies to all of your wage and earning income, regardless of how much you make, unlike the old age and disability insurance portion for Social Security, which is capped at a wage income that's something around $90,000 now and that is indexed each year for inflation. So that is included also in the combined top federal and state effective rate. In addition, he wanted the current and the future years to show the effect of the governor's proposal to impose a 10.95% top statutory rate and the effect of President Obama's budget proposal, which would reinstate the limitation on itemized deductions beginning in 2012, which under current law that's not reinstated until 2013. And another thing that the future years show is that it shows the imposition of an additional 0.9% rate on health insurance through the payroll tax at the federal level for people with earnings over $200,000 for single filers and $250,000 for married couples filing jointly. So that piece shows up from 2013 to 2015. There's also an interaction between the limitation on itemized deductions and the marginal tax gradient at the state level, because the federal limitation on itemized deductions eliminates the deductibility of state income taxes. It limits it to 20% of state income taxes for very, very high income filers. It's sort of an abstract limit because as the way it works is that your itemized deductions are reduced as your income increases, but they're never reduced to less than 20% of your total itemized deductions. What happens is that as your income increases, your state income taxes increase too. So it takes a long time to get to the point where 80% of your state income taxes have been taken away from you through the limitation. And being curious about how many people were affected, it shows you at the top of the second page that when we looked at the 2008 income tax sample, the sample extrapolated to the population showed that about 140,000 Minnesota returns were affected by the limitation on itemized deductions. And of those, only about 1,000 had their state income taxes fully disallowed. So the marginal tax gradient, which takes that into account as though they were the very highest income filers, is really going to be something smaller than that for most high-income filers. But what Representative Banyan wanted to show on the table was the highest possible rate for the highest possible wage earner in the state. So that's what the table shows. Mr. Chair, I have some more comments about the history of the table if you'd like me to share them, but I think you're a little I don't know if you'd like me to do that.
Well,
or
why
not.
Don't you go ahead and do that briefly if you could.
Okay, there are several factors that affect both the combined top federal and state rate and what the marginal tax gradient is. First, this will be changes in what the federal top statutory rate is, changes in what the state top statutory rate is, the whether there's federal deductibility, whether there's state deductibility, the removal of the earnings cap on the health insurance portion of the payroll tax, the additional health insurance tax that was imposed beginning in 2013 as part of the health care reform law enacted last year, and finally the limitation on itemized deductions, which first took effect in 1991 to 2005, then was phased out as part of the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act of 2001 from 2006 to 2009, fully eliminated in 2010, the tax year that we just completed. And then the federal law extends that elimination to 2011 and 2012, although the president proposes to curtail that and reinstate the limitation in 2012. So it would come back in 2013 regardless, but the president's budget proposes to bring it back in 2012. So if you look at the table from 1970 to 1984, working from the bottom up, there are two things in effect here that affect the combined top effective rate, and that's what the top federal rate is, adjusted for the fact that the state allowed deduction of federal taxes, and then the top state rate, adjusted for the fact that the federal government allowed the deduction of state taxes. And those two things have an interaction. So if you look, you see that the combined rate in the third column actually decreases from 1970 to 1972, even though you see that the top state rate is increasing. So if you look at the two columns, and if you were just add those numbers together, you'd think, well, it's going to be a bigger combined rate. But because of this double deductibility, you see that the combined top rate is actually going down, although the state share of that is going up, which is what you see in the increase in what Representative Banyan calls the marginal tax gradient. Things stay the same through 1984 with things moving around as the top state statutory rate changes. The top state statutory rate looks very high compared to what we have now, and that's because the federal deductibility required it to be high to raise relatively, it certainly wasn't similar levels of revenue to what we raise now, but in order to raise a similar proportion of people's income as revenue, the top rate had to be higher since people were allowed to deduct their federal taxes. And as you see, the top federal rate was very high, so the federal tax deduction was worth quite a bit to high-income filers at the state level. And what you look at over there is that marginal tax gradient, which is the effective rate paid by the very high-income filer on their last dollar of income, is very low compared to what the top state statutory rate is. In 1985 and 1986, as I was preparing these remarks yesterday, I discovered there are a couple of errors in the table. The rows for 1985 and 1986 with federal deductibility, the marginal tax gradient should be 3.99 rather than 4.95. So I'm going to be preparing a corrected version of this memo for Representative Banyan, and I can share it with the committee as well, although I suspect that 1985 and 1986 are probably not the years you're most interested in. We move on to 1987, and that's when the federal deductibility was eliminated, and there you see the top statutory rate decreasing rather dramatically from 14% to 9%. At the same time, the marginal tax gradient actually increased, and the real driver of the increase was the fact that the top federal statutory rate also decreased. So the value to a state taxpayer of deducting their state taxes at the federal level became much smaller because the federal rate was much smaller. And that is what goes on over the next few years. As you see, the top federal rate decrease to 31%. You see the marginal tax gradient creep up. Another thing that's coming into play there in 1991 is the uncapping of the health insurance payroll tax, which is what accounts for the jump in the combined top federal and state effective rate, because now that 1.45% employee share plus the 1.45% employer share, which I consulted with Representative Banyan, and he agreed with the conventional wisdom that the employer share flows through and is borne by the employee. So this is actually showing the full 2.9%, which is generally accepted by economists as what happens in the marketplace. So that 2.9 is in there starting in 1991. And then what else happens in 1991 is that we also have the limitation on itemized deductions coming into play, so that the state rate, the state effective rate, is going to be higher because high-income taxpayers are only able to deduct 20% of their state income taxes at the federal level. Then things remain relatively constant until we get to 2001, where we see the federal rate decrease, and it's sort of phased down from 2001 to 2003. The state rate has decreased at the end of the 1990s. That went down, and you see some corresponding changes in the combined rate and in the marginal rate. The federal rate decreases, and then starting in 2005, the limitation on itemized deductions begins to phase out at the federal level, and it is phased out through 2010 when it's not in effect. And you see the marginal tax gradient drop to its lowest level in a long time in 2010, and it's because of that elimination of the limitation on itemized deductions. Then we see the marginal tax gradient jump in 2011, and that jump is due to the fact that Representative Banyan wanted me to show the governor's 10.95% rate in here. So the 10.95% rate comes into play there in 2011, and that continues through 2013. From 2012 to 2013, you see a little decrease in the marginal tax gradient. That's because at the federal level, the top federal marginal rate is scheduled to go back up to 39.6%, unless the Bush tax reductions from 2001 are further extended by Congress. The 39.6% higher rate decreases the cost to a state taxpayer of the 10.95% tax rate. The reason there isn't a bigger drop in the marginal tax gradient, or rather in the combined effective rate in that year, is because the new payroll tax on health insurance is also coming into play in that year, and that's sort of where things stay going forward. Now, I did mark in on my copy for the last 4 years of this what the marginal tax gradient would be for a taxpayer who was not fully affected by the limitation on itemized deductions, and that's much lower. It would be 7.12% in 2012, and then 6.61% in 2013 through 2015. So that is a kind of long snapshot of what this table is about.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Manzi. One quick question for me is, take mine for example. In 2013, 39.6, 10.95, but why aren't we including my second highest category, which would be the FICA taxes at about, since I pay both sides, like 15%. Of course, that's on up to 100 and whatever, but why isn't that calculated in here?
Mr. Chair, in discussions with Representative Banyan when he requested this information, he wanted the rate on the very highest income wage earner hypothetically possible, and he wanted the rate on the margin. And on the margin, for someone earning, say, $200,000 of income, they would not be paying FICA tax on their $200,001 of income. So that's why it's not included. It's only the health insurance portion, which doesn't have a cap, that's included.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Dr. Spry. And I'm sorry, Dr. Spry, but at about 10:25, we'll go to Ms. Larson, and then the Senate will be in session. Dr. Spry.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a fascinating document. There was a lot of detail, but I want to hit a couple of the highlights. First, during a period where you might think, well, the federal rate was 50% and the Minnesota rate was, say, 17%, 50 plus 17% is 67%. And so somebody might naively think that we had 67% rates if you just looked at those two tables. But one of the things this highlights is for 1970 to 1990, which are often thought of as the good old days of high taxation and economic growth in Minnesota, the average over those 20 years for the top tier combined Minnesota and federal tax rate was 45.9. And under the administration, federally and the Dayton administration, we would go to 53.48. That's the highest combined marginal rate for the top tier in many people's lifetime, going back the length of the data. But secondly, if you think about competitiveness or the incentive to move to a lower tax state, a zero tax state like Florida, Texas, the statutory state rate matters, but the federal treatment deductibility really matters. So during those good old days, we had the maximum gain, because for a high-income person, some of their taxes would be part of the standard deduction or itemized deductions or lower tiers of the income tax. But the maximum gain from leaving Minnesota and going to Florida in, say, 1986 was just under 4% of your income. So you may ask Minnesota, Florida, there was a tax slope, a competitiveness on the income tax, which is one part of the picture, but it historically was really low. And one thing, since this excellent memo by House Research was prepared, that has changed is both in Minnesota, there's references to the governor has revised his budget. And at the federal level, President Obama is in the process of revising his budget documents. And it's very frustrating because this is based on his old budget, and his public statements that are well publicized are he wants to really take away itemized deductions of taxpayers at the top part of the income distribution. And so I don't know for sure because he doesn't have the budget documents out, but it may be that the piece limitation could be understating what federal policy would be under the president's budget. He may be taking away all the deductibility of state and local taxes for these high-income individuals. And again, the Obama administration just hasn't put out the final budget document to see exactly what specific deductions the president is talking about. That would mean our tax gradient, instead of under the piece limitation being just about 10%, would be the full 10.95%. So what the governor is proposing for the top tier taxpayers is really quite a novel experiment. It is something that both with the combined federal and state tax rates we're looking at under the administration's budget, and with the maximum tax savings by moving to Florida or Texas or another zero income tax state. It's just really fascinating, and hopefully that maybe explains the marginal rates. And I really thank the commissioner for emphasizing the importance of effective marginal tax rates, because while the cost study looked at C-corps, particularly doing business in many states, if you looked at effective marginal tax rates for C-corps whose customers are in the upper Midwest and mainly in Minnesota, you get a little bit different answer on the C-corp side. And if you look at startup businesses, I would never advise anybody to start up a C-corp in Minnesota. You'd probably want to start up as a pass-through entity. that's common advice, and pass through entities, at least for the tax gradient, which is a little different than the combined tax rate on wages, the tax gradient, because we treat pass-through income, capital gains, dividends, and wage income the same. The federal deductibility is a little bit different, perhaps. It's very complex, but I think you'd have, even for things besides wage income, a bad marginal tax gradient under the proposed budgets compared to the historical precedents.
Thank you, Dr. Spry. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Spry referenced that the governor has revised his budget, and I did send Representative Banyan an earlier version of this memo, which included the 5% surcharge on very high-income individuals, which has been dropped from the governor's budget, and that item has also been removed from this memo. So I believe with regard to the governor's budget that the rates calculated here reflect the governor's supplemental budget recommendations with the surcharge gone.
So it was a dropping of the fifth tier.
Yes.
And I do thank the governor for that. Okay, questions? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Spry, welcome back to the Senate. I thought I heard you, but can you confirm again? Did you say 4% was the differential in previous years for folks to move to non-tax states? You said that based on all the combined factors, that there was that slope of 4%. What is it now if we adopt the 10.95%?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, currently for tax year 10, which might be the best way to say, it's 5.1 because tax year 11 in the calculations has the governor's budget recommendations in it and is 7.12. And then in 12, with some of the federal changes, that goes up to 10.18. So I think these piece limitations and whatever additional limitations on federal deductibility that the president proposes in his budget and Congress may or may not enact are just extremely important because under current law, if I'm doing a couple extra calculations that I did that are similar to this, if you do nothing with your 7.85% rate, that combined effective federal and state marginal tax rate for Minnesotans is going to go up from last year's 43% to approximately 50% because of the addition of the additional federal health care tax and because of the piece limitations and the 39.6% rate in current law.
Senator Irvin.
I'm still trying to come back to layman's terms. I'm not an economist by any stretch of the imagination. If you're saying that previously a taxpayer would have the incentive to move and it would be a 4% savings in income tax in previous years, but now, because of the changes proposed by Governor Dayton and President Obama, that incentive has increased. Is that tax gradient? And would it then be 10% or 2.5 times what it was previously?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that tax gradient bounces around a lot. So if you look at 1970, 1971, 85, 86, it was 4% or less. Other years it was 4.5, 4.7. It bounces around because tax law, as you know, changes. But yeah, we're looking at what in the limit for these high income individuals would be more than a doubling of the disincentive to stay in Minnesota. Another way to put it is with the 53.48% rate, a taxpayer would be happier to shelter $100,000 of taxes through the wasteful use of tax avoidance planning instead of working harder or investing in a riskier venture to make another $100 because the tax code's taking, in layman's terms, more than half of each marginal dollar.
Thank you. Senator? Okay. Just we will, if we could, one last, or Ms. Manzi, and then Representative Runbeck, and then we do need to go to Jill Larson.
Senator?
We don't? Okay. Everyone back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, we keep hearing that the rich don't pay taxes, and I'd like, Mr. Chair, if we even maybe could get some testimony, but I think what this increase in tax rates does is really affecting the people who are growing businesses, who are, you know, putting their money into an effort to build something, versus the rich who have the passive income who can shelter all of it. And you were kind of discussing that, but I think there is something to that, that there is a potential in the municipal bonds that are not taxable. You can shelter all of your money. But, you know, who this really hurts are the people who are building our future. And I think we need to kind of have a better appreciation. Maybe you can share something on that, Dr. Spry.
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, economists think people respond to price. If beer is a dime at the ballpark, a lot of people go to the game, and a lot of people buy beer. If some investments are tax-preferred, completely tax-free, like municipal bonds, if an individual perhaps had a high net worth, did not want to invest in startup businesses, risky businesses, equity investments, and they were looking at, do I put my money in a Minnesota bank? Or do I put my money in municipal bonds, you can avoid and have a combined federal and state effective tax rate of zero through municipal bonds. One word of caution is there's sometimes an implicit tax that you pay because the gross rate of return on any investment responds to the tax treatment. However, a lot of the marginal buyers of municipal bonds are perhaps not subject to the governor's tax plan. They're in other states or other tax brackets. So I'm not sure how much of that would come would be in play. That's a hard calculation to do. But I want to note that's sort of possible. And so if you want to divert investment funds from startup Minnesota equity to tax shelters, you have a very good plan to do that from the governor.
Thank you.
Ms. Manzi, and then Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, back to Senator Ortman's question, the measure that Representative Banyan defined as the marginal tax gradient is getting at the question of what the marginal cost is to the business of remaining in Minnesota rather than moving to a no-tax state. This memo, I want to restate, like I said at the beginning, was in response to his very specific request for the maximum possible rate. And I do want to note that in 2012 through 2013, you see that those rates are very high. It's 10.18% in 2012 and then 10.08% in the following years. That's the rate, again, for a person who would be fully subject to the limitation on the deduction of state income taxes at the federal level. So they would have that brought down to the 20% that's in the current law for what is called the Pease limitation. And that, you know, I did look at this sample extrapolated to the population, and that affects about 1,000 of the 140,000 Minnesota returns that are subject to that limitation. So for most very high income taxpayers, the marginal tax gradient would be in between what the gradient would be without the Pease limitation, which is 7.12% for 2012 and then 6.61% for the following years, and the 10.18 and the 10.08% levels in this table. Had I been writing this memo for a more general audience, I hope I would have chosen to include that sort of caveat on those very high rates somewhere in the memo, since it was in response to a very specific request and he wanted the very highest rate. I included it, and then there's a little paragraph above it that notes that it's just the 1,000 of 140,000.
So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Spry, would be safe to say if you go from 1985 to 2015, you'd have twice the incentive if you're a wealthy Minnesotan to leave the state? Yes or no? Then I've got one more question, and we're going to shut her down. Yes or no?
Under current law at the federal level, subject to the Pease limitation maximum.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Rolls, and then we have to shut her down.
No, I'm not sure if we have time. Thank you, Mr. Chair, but good to see you again, Dr. Spry. And you've often talked about dead weight loss and excess burden. Can you explain how the governor's proposal is going to affect that?
Dr. Spry.
Okay.
Yes or no? Just kidding. Very quickly, though.
Right. I think there's unanimity among economists that the excess burden of a tax is an inefficiency is proportional to the square of the tax rate. So the column you don't see is taking the combined tax rate and multiplying it by itself to square it. So even though we are looking, and again, this is in the limit from 43 to 53.48, and that looks like 10 percentage points, and sometimes people describe it as so many boxes of pizza per week, that the inefficiency and dead weight loss would be probably 60% more than with the current system of a 43% tax rate. And again, just like in spring, everybody's thoughts turn to going outside and the wonders of nature. In a tax code with a 53.48% marginal tax rate, those taxpayers' thoughts turn to how can I spend a lot of money and devote a lot of resources and change my investment decisions, maybe from startup equities to more tax-preferred things. Also, treasuries are completely free of Minnesota state income tax. And those different kinds of decisions, not just moving to another state, but even people that stay here, making bad decisions because the tax code rewards those decisions and punishes other decisions that you might like investment in startups or working harder, all lead to more deadweight loss.
Thank you, Doctor, and I hate this is a great discussion here. But Senator Ortman, about next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to be meeting at the call of the chair tomorrow. We hope to have an agenda. We'll continue and make certain that we have time for Ms. Larson, since she can't be accommodated today.
And I apologize to Ms. Larson for the time running out here. Senator Sanjum?
Just a quick note. Handed out a little piece of paper here from the Office of the Governor of Texas. This is real stuff. Just look down in that third paragraph. Some operations out of New Ulm, Minnesota, moving to Angleton, Texas. We don't know the whys or the wherefores, but it's happening, it's real. And I can only wonder how often Texas businesses come to Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Sanjum. He did put his name on his sheet. Thank you for that, Senator. With that, watch your emails for next week.
Mr. Chair, not likely to be before Tuesday. Our next meeting will probably be on Tuesday.
Okay, thank you, Senator Ortman. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.